Can Talk. Entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
Today's episode is an amazing piece of motorsport history, the 1950 Watkins Glen Grand Prix. There were three races held that day, the Seneca Cup, the Queen Charlotte Cup, and the Grand Prix. The entrance list was a veritable who's who of post-war racing. Miles Collier, Fred Wacker, Cameron Argensinger, William Milliken, George Huntoon, Briggs Cunningham, and Sam Collier, who sadly was killed during the race. With over 100 entries, this was a major race event in a now famous race course's very young history. Very little footage exists of Watkins Glen during its 1948-55 public roads era. Alfred Goldschmidt arrives with his Cadillac LR J2. The first race at Watkins Glen was held in 1948 and initiated by Cameron Argensinger, an Ohio resident and law student at Cornell University in Ithaca, who often stayed at his father's summer house on Seneca Lake. The family having been in the area since the early 1800s. Argensinger, an early member of the SCCA, proposed an amateur road race to be called the Watkins Glen Grand Prix to the Watkins Glen Chamber of Commerce. The chamber was enthusiastic. Argensinger selected a 6.6-mile course using mostly paved roads with a short dirt and gravel stretch. Permissions were obtained to close a New York Central Railroad track and the roads needed. And SCCA sanction was obtained. The first race was held at 12 noon on October 2, 1948, a four-lap qualifying race with a standing start. Subsequently, 15 cars started the 8-lap 52.8-mile Grand Prix, and 10 finished. The winner was Frank Griswold of Wayne, Pennsylvania, in a pre-war Alfa Romeo 8C2900 coupe, closely followed by Briggs Cunningham in his famous Buick. Other prominent entrants include William Milliken, the noted aircraft and race vehicle dynamics expert, who rolled his Bugatti 35 on the last lap of the qualifier, giving Milliken's corner its name, Charles Adams, the cartoonist who created the Adams family, and Miles and Sam Collier, major figures in the history of U.S. road racing either side of World War II. During what appears to be a practice session, Briggs Cunningham's Cadillac-powered Le Monstre leads a pair of very new Porsche Speedsters. By 1950, the event captured the imagination of drivers and fans alike. The town of Watkins Glen would have been a very exciting place to be that weekend. A parade lap through the town of Watkins Glen, and Le Monstre ceremoniously leads the parade lap for the race over Stonebridge along White's Hollow for the beginning of the Seneca Cup. Number 98, Alfred Goldschmidt in his Cadillac LR J2. An accident occurred. I don't believe this is Sam Collier's tragic accident, but another that injured a fireman and two spectators. We're now into the Queen Charlotte Cup race. Number 96, David Ash in his MGTD. Number 41, Ken Hill in his Merlin. Number 24, Rallon Keith in his MGTC. Number 82, Paul Farrago in the Fiat Farrago. Number 14, Richard Torland in his pre-war MGPA. Number 63, Marsh Thomas in yet another MGTC, a favorite of racers in a day with no less than 21 MGTCs entered. Number 24, Rallon Keith in his MGTC takes the checkered flag in the Queen Charlotte Cup race. The Grand Prix race begins as the cars race over Stonebridge. Number 2, Cameron Argensinger in his Healey Silverstone. Sadly, this is where the footage ends.
This is Bill Warner of the Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance, and you are listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers in Google Town, talk 1340.com, and you can see us live here in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you've missed any of our 720-some-odd shows, check out Nostalgic Radio and Cars. .com. Good evening, Bobby. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. You're
driving that radio station again?
You're driving today.
Yeah. Okay, that's good. At least we got somebody in the driver's seat that knows what they're doing, besides me. Anyway, no, actually, I'm on the other side. I'm in the microphone side. But anyway, all right, so guys, we got an exciting show for you this evening. Very interesting gentleman coming on. We're going to be talking about something that's going on in Florida. Now, speaking of car shows and things of that nature, the Pittsburgh Grand Prix is still going on this week. Started over the weekend. And they have a whole bunch of stuff going on. So definitely Google Pittsburgh Grand Prix. Pittsburgh Vintage Grand Prix, I should say. Then we have the Shelby American Club. They had their event this past weekend. And then there was the GAA auction up in in someplace in North Carolina. Anyway, so that's what took place this past weekend. And hey, I didn't go anywhere because I had stuff I had to do, because you'll never believe what happened to me. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sports fans, car guys, the last thing you want, keep in mind, we're in Florida and it's stormy out there. The last thing you want is for your computer, you know, they say backup, do this, do that. Well, you know, I had an external hard drive and I'm learning a lesson here. And I had, and it was called an external hard drive cloud, and I forget how many terabytes it had, but it started acting up here in the last couple of months, and as a result of some storm activity, I would say. And finally, it just decided to go poof. And I lost everything. I mean, like 15 years worth of stuff's on there, data on there. I mean, it was a whole bunch of terabytes. But I thought I was doing the right thing, but I had it backed up to an external cloud. So now I'm learning how this all works. But I will tell you this, don't get one with a squirrel cage in it. Get one that's got, what do they call that, Bobby? It's a...
Solid state.
Solid state. Yeah, because... but anyway, so that's that. That was my lesson this week. And so now I've been scrambling to try to get that thing. So I couldn't go anywhere because I had to focus on trying to get all my my data. I give it to a gentleman to kind of work on it. And he's been working on it. We got some of it, but a lot of it's still, as they call it, corrupted. So I will keep you in the loop. Although I will tell you this, that our shows are safe because they're all down here at the radio station here in downtown Clearwater. Now, anyway, so what's going on here in a couple of weeks? We got, well, actually, I think it starts next week, and you've got Speed Week, which at Bonneville Speed Week's coming up. Always wanted to go to that. Been invited to that many times, just never went to it. It's on my bucket list. But what is on my bucket list and what is on the radar, and I'm going to do everything I can to get out there, and that's Monterey Collector Car Week. So we have a number of events that take place out there. You got Legends of the Autobahn. You got the Works Reunion. You've got the Rolex Monterey Historic Races, which is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in a couple weeks. And that's a lot of fun. And then, of course, you've got the Concorso Italiano, and we're going to have our friend Tom McDonald on again. And then, of course, you have the Grand Finale, the Pièce de Résistance, the Pebble Beach Concourse. And that is just one outstanding show. And the thing that I always emphasize and cannot emphasize enough is, you know, it's kind of like Amelia Island. And there's vehicles there that you only read about. And if you get a chance to, and people that you only read about, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the legends are slowly going up to the big great racetrack in the sky. But we've been very fortunate, very thrilled to be able to have some of these people on our radio show. And for me, it was very, very important too, because I mean, these are guys that I read about when I was growing up and as a kid in Northern California, and you know, to be able to see these guys in person, live, talk to them, and then actually have them on the radio show is just totally, you know, totally amazing. Let's just say the Dan Gurney's, the Mario Andretti's, the Roger Penske's, the Carroll Shelby's of the world, the Parnella Jones, who just took off to the sky here a couple of weeks ago, and you know, people like that. You know, Bobby Unser was on our show. I'll never forget when I first met Bobby Unser. I said, I'd like to invite you to be a guest on my radio show. He says, well, what's your show about? And I said, cars, automotive. He says, is it about race cars? Because if you're talking about race cars, I'll come on your radio show. I'll talk race cars with you, but it's got to be about race cars. And he just put emphasis on it, race cars, which kind of remind me of a friend up in Georgia when I bought my 66 Shelby. race car way back when we were talking, and he was in the vintage Mustangs and stuff like that. And he says, "So, Robert, you want to buy my Shelby?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm interested in your Shelby." And you know, it's a race car. It's a race car. It's never going to be anything other than a race car. You know, we converted it to a race car. It's been a race car since 1972. 71. So it was. It was a legitimate, and we'll get into that too, SVRA, which is Sports Vintage Racing Association, or you have HSR. This was a legitimate, and SVRA was pretty much like the Mac Daddy of vintage road race cars. All the cars that campaigned and competed in SVRA were legit former race cars with race history and logbooks prior to 1972. So, having said that, I think it's about time we get. Yeah, I can't wait to get this gentleman on our show tonight. I've met him before. He's probably one of the foremost authorities, experts in cars, in the automobile world field. And I'm really thrilled to have this gentleman on our show. And I think, Bobby, what we ought to do is just go ahead and fire up the stereo there. Let's play a little music that I think everybody can relate to this particular song. This is the theme song to Route 66. And they actually filmed a number of episodes in Florida, coming down US 19. Well, US 19, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, goes all the way to South Florida, down to the Everglades, down to the Tamiami Trail, and across. But anyway, hey, you're tuning in to Nostalgia Getting Cars. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back.
You're listening to my favorite, Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. And how are we doing there, young man? Do we have our guest on the line here? Just about.
Drinking warm water
before. Hey, that happened here a couple of weeks ago. We use this program here. I forget what they call it. It's Adobe Edition or something like that. And what happened was we had a couple of... it's like where we cut and paste and like our little clips that we line up and everything like that. Well, it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's like 20 levels or whatever it is, right? But sometimes what happens is that we forget to erase one of the levels, and then when we're working on top three, then every once in a while we have a bleed over. But nonetheless, that's what happened then. All right, so we got our guest on the line. Super. All right, time to introduce our special guest for the evening. This gentleman is the founder of the Revs Institute in Naples, Florida, and also... member of the Collier Collection, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening the founder of the Revs Institute and the Collier Collection, Miles Collier. How are you this evening, Miles?
I am well, thank you. Delighted to be with you.
Super. Well, I've been looking forward to this for some time because, you know, we always have this debate, who's the car guru expert of experts? Well, in the past, there's been a number of guys out there that are in the top let's say 5 or 10, and obviously we want to include Jay Leno and stuff, but you know, you start talking to people that are real historians and stuff, and you get into names like Bill Warner, who's very good, and then naturally yourself. So I'm really delighted that you could take the time out and hang out with us here. So what I kind of wanted to focus to on first is you wrote a book, and the book was about archaeology and the automobile, and how it kind of relates, because people don't think of archaeology and automobiles, but when you go back in the beginning of time, there really is a connection. What archaeology basically means is it's like where we pick up where they left off, and then you know you discover it, and then you go back and you do all your research. So am I along the right lines there?
Well, more or less. I mean, archaeology is essentially the study of things from the past with a view towards learning about what the past was made of.
Okay.
And the thing that makes archaeological artifacts important is that they bear marks and witness to the people that use them, the life that they've seen as a functional object, and therefore we can learn quite a bit about what was going on years gone by in a way that text, which is history, can't.
So in your book, do you also kind of touch base on how the automobile has basically affected our culture? You know, it's kind of like fashion and art. You know, they all have an impact on, and they're generational as well. And so do you touch on that, how the, you know, because, you know, let's just go turn of the century, a little before that, before cars were even, everybody was riding horses. And so, you know, then suddenly the automobile shows up. And then take us through that process there, how the horse kind of became, now, I don't want to say obsolete, but the car took over, and now we're going through something like that, another kind of renaissance where the car is about to be phased out, possibly, and replaced with something else. So give us that kind of analogy, that comparison.
Well, we have to remember that for 6,000 years, the only way that people could potentiate their ability to travel across the face of the earth is by wind or by muscle power of animals or by flowing water. And it wasn't until the 19th century that a new form of energy was discovered, which is basically fossil energy in the form of coal, and by using that to boil water, create steam, we created a whole new industrial level of prime movers that could be used for manufacturing, could be used for transportation, and so on. Nevertheless, despite the fact that that was often referred to by people as the age of steam, the age of steam was in actuality the age of the horse. And that's because at no time until the late 19th, early 20th century were as many horses in functional operation in urban areas as they were at that time. The U.S. had 26 million working horses in 1910.
That's a lot of horses.
That's a lot of horses. And the problem with horses is they have a mind of their own. You have to imagine them in traffic just as dense as we experience today in, say, rush hour. And the problem was that horses spook. They get scared. They're unreliable. They are biological machines in the sense that they do a lot of peeing and pooping. All of this is something that you have to deal with on the street. They live cheek by jowl with the urban developers in high-rise stables. It's a it's really a horse-centric environment, and that's because steam was not something that could be reduced to a small scale like a horse that produced what we might call retail energy. We had steam engines that produced industrial-level energy, trains, steamships, etc. But at the individual level, we were still left with a horse. when the automobile appeared, a four-stroke petroleum-driven vehicle that comes in small denominated horsepower levels, everything changed. Of course, though, as you recognize or should recognize, the car was completely dependent for its development on the bicycle. So many of the things that end up governing cars were first developed on the bicycle, including the technology, I'd add.
Well, that brings a question for our listeners. When was the first bicycle created, produced?
Well, that would take us back to 18th century, maybe. We might not really think of it as a bicycle. It's essentially what would, if Fred Flintstone designed a bicycle, that's what you'd get. It's foot-powered, it's two-wheel, it's connected by a wooden beam that you sat on, you drove the thing with your feet, had iron tires, weigh about 100 pounds. They were fairly horrific. It wasn't until the late 19th century that the modern bicycle emerged. Ball bearings with wire wheels, pneumatic tires with resistance welded tube frames, and so on and so forth. And that really did become a revolutionary product because it was for the first time that people actually had privacy during their time of travel. They didn't have to be crammed cheek by jowl into a horse trolley or an electric trolley or some other kind of mass-produced device or have to walk. So all of a sudden you had this thing that was faster than a horse. It was could be used recreationally. It could be used to get to work. And it was considered a hallmark of being technologically with it.
Let's talk a little bit about the Revs Institute. Now, you come from a family that has a rich racing tradition. In fact, I was reading somewhere, is there a connection between the Collier family and Watkins Glen at the initial, the inaugural race up there? Were you instrumental in making that race come to fruition?
I don't know that my dad and my uncle were instrumental in making it happen. Cameron Argensinger was the guy that was the driving movement behind it.
Okay.
But they certainly were friends. And I know that Cameron consulted my dad about certain safety aspects and so on and so on. But both my dad and my uncle did race in the first Watkins Glen race, which was 1948. And they did it in two MGTC cars that had been modified for racing.
Now, somewhere else I was reading that your family, your dad and your uncle, were some of the original distributors, importers of the MG brand?
Before World War II, they were the U.S. representatives for MG in the United States.
Interesting.
Which gets to show that timing is everything.
Timing.
Because it wasn't a good deal before World War II.
Okay. Well, what's interesting is that, of course, they were involved with MGs and British cars, and of course, most notably in a lot of the early races in the late 40s, early 50s, sports car racing. It was, there was a lot of British cars in there, a few Italian cars, but you yourself, you're kind of pretty much a Porsche guy, right?
I have a lot of experience with Porsches, though I don't really view myself as a Porsche person.
Okay.
I view myself as an interesting car person.
Okay.
And in the lineup of interesting cars, Porsches are pretty close to the front because they're really interesting.
Okay.
But so are many other cars interesting, like that, say the Citroën DS19. Now that's interesting.
Oh yeah, air ride suspension and some other really interesting, innovative technological.
Off-the-wall technology.
Yeah. Well, now, let me ask you this. Okay, so, because I want to get into this a little bit, talking about collecting and a few things like that and the mindset. So, your thoughts on, there are some people that just collect a brand. They've got either all Porsches, all Ferraris, all Shelby Mustangs, all Corvettes, versus a guy that has a little bit more of an eclectic collection like yourself, you know, where they got maybe a Ford and a Porsche and a Shelby and a Ferrari and a Lamborghini and a Maserati and an Alfa and so on. So in your experiences, do you notice character differences, profile differences with those type of collectors?
Well, I don't know that I've ever looked at it that way. I think that if we think about collecting as being a continuum where you you start with sort of a restricted horizon, and then over time you may begin to broaden that horizon. One of the logical ways to get started in collecting cards is to have a one-mark focus, because there's a lot less material that you have to get your arms around. After all, car collecting is probably one of the most information-intensive, one of the most data-rich fields of collecting there is. So make life easy on yourself. Collect MGs, collect Porsches, collect, you know, whatever it is, and then once you're comfortable and you've gotten a lot of those principles under your belt, then you can start adding up the cards. And that turns out to be the route that I took.
Okay. So in your collection, now I've been down there a few times, and actually I was down there, I believe, when it was the Collier's collection, and then it became the Revs Institute, probably within the last 15, 20 years, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And I think they were always like only open to car clubs and people like that. Is the Revs Institute now open on a regular basis and available to the public?
Revs Institute is open 3 days a week to the general public. We're open Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays from 10 to 4, and you can find out all about us on our website.
Okay. Now, what is the main focus of the Revs Institute?
The vision statement for the Revs Institute basically calls for Revs to be the single most useful resource to the historical car and meaningful car communities worldwide. The operative words are useful resource.
Okay.
So that means data, that means history, that means photographs, that means materials, that means producing intellectual property, that, such as the archaeological automobile, the book I wrote. It means instituting educational programs online, as well as in person. It means producing media that's both educational and entertaining, and so on and so on and so on.
Okay. So now, what are some of the, if I show up at the doorstep, what are some of the things I can expect to see when I get there?
Well, a bunch of cars.
Okay, that's good. The collection consists of what? Somewhere around 100 cars or something like that's in there?
We're about 125 cars at this point.
Okay. Do those cars stay there for a long period of time? Do they get rotated? Are there cars in the back that you pull out? How does that work?
Well, we wish we could rotate cars. We have exactly the wrong size galleries for the size of our car collection. And what that means is that all the cars just fit in all the galleries, which means it's really hard to rotate cars. Now, we've figured out ways around that. So, yes, we do rotate things. We have special exhibits. But we also offer educational programs at the museum. For example, we have a program to teach you about how to work on old school automobiles, how to troubleshoot the motors, brakes, suspension, and even some introductory metal shaping. And that's in an organization that's wholly owned by Revs called Revs Ed.
Oh. So how do you qualify that, and is there an age limit?
There is no age. Well, there's on the young side, we probably like kids to be 10 or more.
Okay.
The majority of our students are from the teenage years to whatever. We've had one gentleman and his wife who were in their late 70s sign up for this, and they loved it. And by the way, the woman was a more skilled mechanic at the end than the gentleman was.
Interesting. Interesting. So how long do these courses last?
They are designed, the length of the courses is designed to be bite-sized. So for each of our courses is designed to take 8 contact hours, and that generally consists of 4 sessions of 2 hours each.
Okay.
So here's the deal. You come into our Engines 101 course. You think cars are operated by magic. At the end of 8 hours, you are capable of installing new points in a distributor along with the condenser, putting it on a distributor machine and setting the dwell. You can then reinsert the distributor in the engine and set the timing properly. You can adjust the valve. You can set the carburetor idle, things of this nature. And there you are.
Wow, you're a full-fledged mechanic.
That's not bad for 8 hours.
No, not bad at all. Okay. What does the course cost? What's the fee?
The course is around $300.
Okay. So now, can this all be done in one day, or do you have to make multiple trips? I mean, what about people that are from out of town?
We offer a variety of different formats for this.
Okay.
So we generally don't try and do the whole program in one day. We find that 2 days for the whole program works pretty well. We have a weekend program, we have an after work program in the evening, and we have a daytime program. And they come in a variety of timings, as I said, and all of that can be found on our website under RevZed.
Uh-huh. Does that give me access to the library and all that stuff too? I mean, is it a one-time fee that allows me to kind of participate in everything, or is it a focused program?
The RevZed program, the $300 pays for the RevZed classroom material.
Okay.
The museum is a different thing, though. I will say this. You get to the RevZed classroom by walking through our workshop, and there's always something to look at going to the RevZed class.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. Does the Revs Institute, do you restore your own cars only, or do you actually take on customer cars and restore those?
We do not take on customer cars because with 125 cars that require periodic maintenance and servicing, we really don't have the manpower to do it.
Okay.
We are capable of doing full-blown restoration, and we've done them on our cars, but even that's not a good use of our shop talent. What we prefer to do is send cars that require a full restoration to identified specialists who are adept in that particular make and model.
Okay. Now, is there any way that someone that has an interest in restoring cars that attends one of your other classes, that they can be promoted to work in the restoration shop, or does that work at all?
That doesn't work that way.
Okay.
Understand that RevZed is not designed to be a vocational program.
Okay.
It's a recreational program, and more important, it's designed to expose people to how the material world works through manual labor, work with your hands and your head. Because we live in a time where the world is so digitally oriented, so office-oriented, that there is a paucity, a real demand out there to engage with the world. We want to do that in programs for schools, colleges, organizations of all kinds. And the idea is to teach them about working in the material world and using the cars as a vehicle to do it.
Okay. Now, and then the library basically consists of books, literature, memorabilia. So it's a research facility. So how does one participate? How does one have access to that? Let's say
You ask.
Just ask?
You ask, yeah.
Is there a fee for that?
No, there's not a fee to come in and do research. If you want us to do some research for you, for some reason, look something up, then there's a fee.
Okay.
That is part of being the most useful resource to the historical car and meaningful car community.
Okay, very good. Now, how does the Revs Institute compare to Simeon's Foundation and let's just say the Peterson Museum? Just some comparisons or differences.
The biggest difference between Revs and Fred Simeon's collection and the Peterson can be derived just from reading the names. They are museums. We're an institute.
Ah, okay.
There's a reason we're not called Revs Museum. We think that cars are important. We are extremely fortunate to have one of the best car collections on the planet. But the cars are really a necessity to make us legitimate as people who can have opinions, and I'm talking about thoughtful, considered opinions, about how to think about and how to deal with historical automobiles as artifacts of the past, indeed as archaeological artifacts.
Okay. So now that raises this question. In your opinion, in the last, let's just say, 125 years, actually it's been longer than that, probably over 130.
135.
I was going to say, yeah, over 130. How do you feel that the automobile has evolved? Do you think it's evolved slowly, gradually, on pace? We're advanced a little bit. What's your take on that?
The automobile has advanced in a way that is typical of any kind of disruptive technology. So the automobile has advanced the same way that personal digital assistants, now called smartphones, or the Walkman went to the Discman, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is the automobile appeared in a fairly primitive form, but it was good enough to attract a series of hobbyists who helped the form factors and function of the technology of the automobile move forward to the point that it became acceptable to the general market out there who was looking for a utilitarian object. It satisfied the requirements so perfectly that it experienced a period of explosive growth in the 20s and the 30s. And once it saturated the market, it then proliferated into sub-markets by the hundreds, and so we have so many different forms of automobiles today, you know, station wagons, to sports cars, to pickup trucks, to mini vans, to SUVs, it goes on and on and on and on, and that's because the markets were becoming saturated, especially specialty uses began to drive the system. Now, ultimately, that system gets so specialized and so diverse that there's really no more room for significant development. And then comes a major technological shift, and everything starts over again.
Okay.
Well, possible technological shifts would be plug-in electric or autonomous vehicles, self-driving vehicles.
All right, I'm going to go to jump back into the 50s. Okay, so we're right really at the rocket/jet age. And, I mean, there was a TV show called The Jetsons back then when I was a little kid. I used to watch that. And so now we're talking about when you hear jet age, rocket age, you're thinking of flying cars. And there was all this talk about that, and there was, you know, concept cars and prototype cars, dream cars, call whatever you want. Ford did it, General Motors did it, Chrysler did it, and then that all subsided kind of like in the early 60s. So give me your take on that, and that's probably kind of what you're talking about, like where you said today we're into plug-in cars, hydrogen-powered cars, you know, and alternative fuels and things of that nature.
Well, let's not confuse sort of dream car, fantasy cars that were using jet and rocket motifs to create an aura of modernity and advancement around cars. We think of Firebird 1, 2, and 3 that General Motors
produced. Right.
Don't even look like automobiles. Then there is the concept that you also mentioned, which is flying cars. Go back to any popular mechanics magazine from 1953, and I think there's a 50-50 chance that you'll find an article with flying cars in it. It's interesting to note that for the last 70 years, people have been expecting a flying car.
Yeah.
And for the last 70 years, the most advanced digital communications technology you saw was Dick Tracy's wrist radio. And yet today, we experience an advanced technology in the smartphone that puts anything that the craziest science fiction writer could have thought of in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s into the shade, the capacity of a modern smartphone. And we still don't have a flying car. What that says is, when it comes to being a pundit thinking about the future, pundits are always, number one, nowhere near radical enough in the way they think about certain things, and number two, way too conservative in the way they think about other things.
Okay. So, having said that, can we anticipate flying cars in the next 50 years, let's just say?
I believe we probably will see flying cars of some sort.
Okay.
And that's because the enabling technology has emerged. The issue before was there was no technology on which you could build a flying car. You had airplane technology, which is completely incapable of producing a flying car for the mass. But nowadays, with drone technology and with autonomy and with advanced communications and things of this nature, the pieces are in place to actually produce a flying car, which, in order for it to be practical, cannot be piloted by the pilot or the passenger.
You can see
where that's going.
Yes.
That's quite possible.
Okay.
And within the ecosystem that comprises personal mobility, I would guess that there'll be some small animal creeping up out of the water that will indeed be a flying car.
Okay. Like the TV show Supercar back in the early 60s. Okay. All right. So now, here's another topic that comes up all the time. And there are so many, Miles. I mean, I'm really, thrilled that you're here. And but here's one that I know this is like a topic that you like. Original cars, survivor cars, restored cars, over-restored cars. I'm going to let you elaborate on that.
Well, I think the issue is when and should we at all intervene in cars to make them a simulacrum of them they were new? And the thing about what's appropriate for any particular automobile is that the decisions that you go through to come to an answer are not general. They are completely situational. So it depends on the particularities of the situation, whether all you want to do is clean it up a little bit and conserve it. Conservation refers to stabilizing an object in its current condition and preventing it from getting any worse, and perhaps making some minor interventions that keep it or make it functional if it's not functional at this time. Restoration is the process of an intervention that returns the automobile to a state closer to what it was in the past. And whether that state is as it was used, as it was last used, as it was manufactured, It's up to the restorer. It's up to the condition the car is in. It's up to a whole bunch of situational issues. And, you know, then there is, on top of that, some people who have a view of a car in their mind that is so important to them that, in fact, it, when they get one, it the idea of platonic of the platonic ideal drives the situation, and that is a car that isn't really the way the manufacturer made it. It's the car the way we wished it was because we love this car so much, and that's where you see the tendency for over-restored cars. Is people are just exercising their enthusiasm and love of that particular car and just going getting carried away with it. But I can't blame you. I mean, what a great thing that you just absolutely adore this car and you want to do the best by it. Now, if it's an unbelievably important original car and you do that, well, that's a shame, and we hope you wouldn't.
Would you say that the mindset today, in today's market, car collector kind of mindset, that more and more people are recognizing that we should leave the cars more along the lines of the way it was found and preserve it, conserve it, if you will. And because, as we always used to say, and I've said this for decades, cars only original one time. And I understand period correct modifications and things along those lines. But when I see what's happened to the industry where it's really got, you know, people place more emphasis on the value as opposed to, from a monetary perspective, as opposed to the value of the actual vehicle and the archaeological aspect of the car, the historic aspect of the car instead. So give us your thoughts on that.
Well, it's a long, involved question there.
I know.
So, yes, the answer is yes. People are recognizing that originality is a valuable thing in an artifact. You only have to look to what went on or what goes on in other fields of collecting, whether that be fine art, whether that be furniture, whether that be historical costume, whether that be porcelain, and so on. And in every one of these cases, less intervention is more valuable than more intervention. And I think that's because if you begin to sever the connection between the artifact and its historical reality by changing everything, even if you try and keep it looking the same, but you make it a bunch shinier, the historical reality of that object begins to be compromised. As one connoisseur in furniture said, when the appearance of age and history disappears, then authenticity disappears, and the history of the object disappears. And that's something that we want to preserve. The magic of an old car is presumably the fact that it's old. Otherwise, why not just build a replica? And if, therefore, the magic is it's old, I, for the life of me, can't figure out why people restore the thing to look like it's brand new.
Well, yeah, you know, and you touched on something there which is very interesting, and that is the fact that, like you mentioned, art, furniture, vintage guns, most of the time, they're all left the way they were found. But oddly enough, between cars and motorcycles and on occasion boats, they tend to restore or over-restore. But I think it might have something, again, it's that value thing. You know, what's this thing worth? And of course, you know, auctions, I think, have a lot to do with that, have a lot of influence there as well that may not be in the best interest of true car collecting.
Well, look at it this way. The antecedent of virtually every collecting avocation, whether it's furniture or historic houses even, mm-hmm. or a costume, or as you say, firearm, started out when things weren't worth a whole lot of money and there wasn't much difference between an exceptional object and a mediocre object. And here's the key. Automobiles are active matter. That is, they are unintelligible if you're the little green-skinned man from Mars, unless you experience them in operation.
Okay.
Operation, therefore, is incredibly important to these objects. When car collecting first started, the avocation was a hobby, and the way you found desire in the cars that you own was to get them running again because they're active matter, which is absolutely correct. A car that doesn't run is not really a car. So aesthetics was subsumed, or historical accuracy was subsumed to operationality. And a lot of that has held over into the modern era. You talk to people about cars, and they today will still say operation is critical to an automobile. By the way, I agree with that.
Yes.
Where we differ is if you give up every bit of authenticity and historical connection to make the thing operate, you've just basically thrown out the baby with the bathwater.
Interesting. Miles, we are just about up against the clock, and I still have about another 20 questions. Would you be willing to come back for part two next week, same bat time, same bat station? Can we do this next week again and pick up where we left off?
If you let me check my schedule and check my PA and so on and so on.
But, super.
It could be okay.
Okay, very good. Well, one more time here for all our listeners. Tell people if they want to find out more about your book, okay, and
find stores anywhere or Amazon.
Okay, and it's called The Archaeological Automobile, correct?
The Archaeological Automobile.
Okay, and then the Revs Institute?
We have a website, and you can find us under Revs Institute.
Sounds good. Well, Miles, I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Car. It has truly been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I look forward to having you back for part two.
Okie dokie. Well, it's been a pleasure as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And happy motoring.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I want to thank my special guest, Miles Collier, for spending some time with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars just before the checker flag comes in, and talking about the Revs Institute and his book, The Archaeological Automobile. Sounds kind of, I'm getting good at that, Archaeological Automobile. I can say that pretty fast now, and which is kind of cool, you know. And of course, I'm a historian. I do appraisals and stuff on cars, and I'm, you know, when I get the chance to talk to somebody that's very, very intellectual in terms of automobiles, it's just fascinating, really, just to listen to them, you know. So it's kind of cool. So anyway, I want to thank all my listeners for tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. for the most legendary and fascinating names in motorsports and on occasion music. And don't forget to tell your friends to get out and drive your cars. That's very, very important. Drive these rolling archaeological automobiles to car shows. In the meantime, show up at some of the car shows. Stay safe, drive carefully, and love your family.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.